news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind a Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Cops searching 400 homes in 3 states, not to mention a casino.
Go get him. You're authorized for legal force. No warrant required.
You draw your gun, you're a dead man.
It looks to me like you've been living on the streets, and you do not want to die like that.
What you're doing is reacting.
Traumatic experience over and over and over in your mind, just like millions of humans.
My pa hated me, so I hate you.
No, is that who you think?
What do you want me to say?
I don't want you to say anything.
Who will you choose?
Kelly!
Who will you say?
If you're in trouble, I can help.
How are you gonna make your point if you're dead?
Toe tapper there isn't exactly the theme from Shaft. Welcome to episode 113, Hunter, starring Ron Bex. Now, if you don't know who Ron Bex is, you're not alone.
You're in good company. Yeah. They don't either. I mean, honestly, this film, is it Ron Bex Hunter? Like, yeah. Ron Bex is Hunter or Ron Bex Hunter? There's no apostrophe, so I'm assuming it's Ron Bex Hunter, i.e. Sylvester Stallone. Cobra, Steven Seagal, you know, Mark for Death.
Schwarzenegger, Commando.
Exactly. Chuck Norris, Braddock, missing in action.
Ron Bex is missing in action on search engines anyway.
He's missing in action on screen. He's barely a presence, but he is a presence. He's a corpulent one, but sleepwalked the entirety of
his
thing.
Yes, we have to, I guess, talk about the unforgettable figure.
Of Ron Bex. I just want to say, this movie, how did this come across our radar? It was sent to me. I actually contacted Gregory Hatanaka because I wanted to review Samurai Cop 2, being such a fan of the original. And Gregory Hatanaka directed Samurai Cop 2. He owns a company called Cinema Epoch. Mm-hmm. Was nice enough to send me Samurai Cop 2 and some other films. This one here, this Hunter, you took it. You took it home to watch, and you wrote a review, and you're just like,
glowing. Yeah.
This is one of those movies that just, you know, when you, it's like it's manna from heaven because there's so much ludicrousness, and you don't know like what was the thought process behind this.
Yeah.
Who thought this was a good idea? First of all, who is Ron Bex?
Yeah.
Ron Bex, the man receives uber top billing. The font of his.
If his name
is bigger than the title. So, again, I wrongfully assume that Ron Bex must have been making movies for years, lots of action films, big following. Quite wrong. I went on IMDb. The man's got barely one credit to his name.
Yes. and this is odd, too, considering his age. He's by no means a senior citizen, but...
He's not spring chicken.
No, he's... And his physique betrays someone who's... more likely to judge a chili cook-off than dispatch with goons in an action film. And you texted me and said, why is he wearing a Gold's Gym weightlifting belt? And
throughout the duration of the film?
Yeah.
It's sort of hard to see because he's always attired in black, but I noticed this. Whether he's lying in bed, whether he's on the streets taking down drug dealers, he's got this Gold's Gym weightlifting belt that you would see, you know, if the guy was in there, you know, deadlifting like 500 pounds. Why is he wearing that belt?
I have no idea. And
my estimation was it was to my, you know, my guess was to hold
like a girdle.
Corpulent body. Yeah, it was really like a girdle.
So I guess we have to describe Ron Bex. The titular hunter.
Well, he's definitely a corpulent Bo Diddley.
Yeah, he really does resemble the physicality of B.B. King with the face of Bo Diddley and the style.
Wardrobe.
The wardrobe completely.
He favors bolo ties, wide-brimmed hats.
Yes. And he's also a bit of a like old-school lawman that you'd see maybe in the Wild Wild West, because he's got his pathetic little tiny gun in a holster, and he's really, like, he's a quick draw, quick draw McGraw.
Yeah, he also has Billy Dee Williams' hair.
Yes.
And he's a man, he's almost like, he's like this Zen master... cop, and I don't remember right now, but I'm sure it's right at the tip.
Oh, he's a self-help guru as well, and
right.
He's very quotable, and he will dispense with lines like, what the mind can conceive, the mind can achieve. So he's got this little cadence that he works through, and Hunter is a Los Angeles police detective and part of a sex crimes unit.
I was going to say, I don't remember the unit he was working for, but I know you remember it. It was,
I think, an international sex crimes unit. And to add international flavor to this podunk, no-budget film shot mostly in Santa Barbara and Los Angeles or whatever, there is, of all people, someone I'd forgotten about for years and years and years, and I didn't even know he was alive, to be honest. George Lazenby.
Lazenby?
Lazenby?
Potato,
the first James Bond?
No, he was the replacement James Bond.
Oh, okay.
He was the first James Bond after Sean Connery.
Her Majesty's Secret Service,
and he was,
which I've not seen.
I've seen clips here and there, but I mean, the man was James Bond for one film and one film only.
And I could
replace with Roger Moore after that,
And I guess, who was it, Mark Twain? Like, rumors of his demise were greatly exaggerated. I could have sworn he was dead.
Mm.
He is a general. I don't understand his character. You're going to have to explain it to me.
Don't ask me, man.
Okay.
I'm as long as you are in this film.
We're trying to make heads or tails of this. Mm. We have this character, Hunter, who's the head of the sex crimes unit. He is investigating the...
He's investigating many things.
Many things. This film starts with a woman's body found in a water tank, which is one of those tanks that you see in like New York City that sits atop a hotel usually. And this is actually a true story. This was ripped from the headlines. A Canadian student was found dead in a water tank at this very hotel. So this film took that story and just ran with it, and which is a little bit tasteless because that story was... very, very recent. So they really took straight from the headlines like your terrible police show on TV. And this guy, we're introduced to him investigating the death of some college co-ed in a water tank.
Now, how was that?
This is not relevant.
Yeah.
This is not... Yeah, I can't even remember if she was sexually assaulted, but this has nothing to do with the plot, which involves him tracking down a cop killer.
Right.
nothing to do with this. I guess just to establish that he's a detective. Who knows? He's just there.
Well, I mean, he also works in a police station. And I say that with quotes because, I mean, this film was made for $300,000 and it shows. Although some of that money was wasted needlessly on green screen, but we'll get to that in a moment. But I mean, this cop station was literally a high school. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
It was a high school, and Hunter's office was the hallway of a high school.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. He's sitting there in his little office, and his captain walks in and goes, "Hunter, you don't need a desk?" I'm too cool for desks. Meanwhile, he's sitting at a fucking desk.
Yeah.
And don't forget, there's the other subplot. He's also sort of like this avenging Robin Hood character.
Yeah, I guess, well, he is a corrupt cop, and he beats down drug dealers and takes their money. And
but
he,
for a good purpose.
Yeah, he funds an orphanage that's run by his quite smoking half his age girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So he robs from the drug dealers, mm-hmm. funds this program.
And as he's robbing, it's always the same briefcase. He's robbing. Yeah. You know, for the second time, the third time, give me that briefcase. Give me that briefcase. And it's like it's. And he's like, "No, it's not, it's my money." He's like, "It's not your money, it's drug money."
Yeah. Well, it it's not your money either.
It's still money, whether it's drug money or, man, work hard. Is out on the street turning out those drugs? I mean,
well, it's certainly not Hunter's money
it's
either.
It's not Hunter's money. They go, and sometimes when he tries to shake down these low-level drug dealers, unfortunately, accidents happen. He ends up killing them.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh, man, it's all this for drug money. It's just drug money."
Yeah.
Well, okay, Hunter, you're not exactly, I mean, for all your homilies of, you know, how to live
a chaste and a spiritually fulfilled life, not exactly.
Not exactly pure of heart, this Hunter.
No. And since I guess Hunter's girlfriend, she helps take people off the street through some machinations involving Hunter's superior at the police station, he takes in a runaway from Tennessee, whose name is Kelly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also interesting. We should know the name of his captain, Captain Goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Goodwill Hunting. It's all part of the. He's a hunter. Who knows?
So yeah, and this Runaways is like this real hick chick. I mean, this real hillbilly, clad in like you know Daisy Dukes,
short shorts,
one of those plaid shirts, you know, tied up.
Yes.
The cleavage showing. And Hunter's, you know, he's not very happy to have this this intruder in his home life, and. So, well, you could stay for a day, and then it's a week, and so on and so mm-hmm. forth.
Now, you mentioned earlier the green screen prevalence here. When we're introduced to Kelly, oh, I gotta say, the captions are just fantastic. In addition to the green screen, we have tons of timestamps. Every victim has a number.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're introduced to Kelly, we flash back to where she's from, and it says, "From the wilds of Tennessee,"
mm-hmm.
or the backwoods, I think they actually say. Tennessee is Los Angeles. They just stamp Tennessee across it. Part of it looks green screened. Her home in Tennessee is green screened. Hunter's nightmares are green screened, including a chat he has with probably an ex-girlfriend that's taking place at the beach, and he wakes up in a sweat. That's green screened. It prompts the question, if you're going to shoot a film in California, why would you green screen a beach?
Mm.
Like, at least you could say, okay, they didn't have the budget to go to Tennessee. This $300,000 went to numerous green screens. And in the finale, when there's a tete-a-tete showdown between the cop killer and Hunter, there's a green screen, but it's the back of the green screen. So they're still in the room where there's a green screen. They're just not using the green screen. This is the takeaway message from this thing. Holy crap, is there a lot of green screen. Mm. George Lazenby is introduced with the same device. Everything it has a weird shimmer of unreality to it, and we don't know if this is intentional. We're still trying to make heads or tails of whether this thing is for real, a la Dangerous Men,
mm-hmm.
like an auteur vision, a la Bream, a la Wizo. Mm-hmm. I still don't know.
Now, we mentioned lots and lots of Hunter's skills. There's another skill he has. He's a musician.
Maybe of prodigious talent, because he's able to turn a trumpet
into a saxophone.
He has a little place to get away from it all in the California foothills.
Yeah.
And he takes his trumpet there, and in the soundtrack, his trumpet playing is overdubbed with what's clearly a saxophone, mm-hmm. and his fingering also doesn't match the notes, as if you could, they're presuming the audience can't tell the difference between a saxophone and a trumpet.
That was just amazing.
I'll
break this description of this, you know, unbelievably intricate plot with a little personal anecdote. Okay, when I was in grade 8, and I was in music class, the instrument I wanted to play more than anything else was a saxophone. Why did I want to play the saxophone?
Because of The Simpsons? Saxophone.
But this is before Lisa? The Simpsons. Okay. I guess I'm revealing my antiquity. But no, it was the In Excess Never Tear Us Apart video. They're in Prague, and the guy's up there playing that sax. It's a wonderful solo. So I want to play the sax. I could have chose a clarinet. I could have chose a trumpet. I could have chose the flute. Any other woodwind instrument. I chose the sax. Now, my mistake was I chose the tenor sax. Mm-hmm. What I should have chosen was
the alto sax, yeah.
Because that's the one that was being played in the NXS video. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's about 30 pounds lighter than the tenor sax.
Yeah.
And we had to take the saxophone home pretty much on a daily basis and practice. And I'd be like trying to sit in my basement trying to play like the fucking Sounds of Silence or like Good King Wenceslas, you know, for the Christmas pageant. And I couldn't do it, man. I was pitiful. Like, I would never change my reed, okay?
Oh, no.
So, yeah, I was using the entire, like, read for the entire year. It was just bad. But when we were in class, so I would
never... Did it sound like a goose when you're honking into this thing?
Yeah.
Like, did you have any sort of chops?
No. Let me tell you how this is relevant to Hunter. I got in a lot of trouble because I would never take my instrument home. Because it's way too heavy. I had to walk home from school. This thing weighed 50 pounds, right? I just couldn't do it. I was a lazy kid. So I didn't know how to play worship. So when we're in music class and we're playing like O Tannenbaum or something, right? You know,
and great jazz standard.
Everybody, and this is Barry Simpson's, everybody's playing, you know, and all I'm doing is pretending to blow into my instrument. It sounds more dirty than it is. And fake finger. Okay? Uh-huh. So
it also sounds more dirty than it is.
Exactly. So I wanted to, you know, have a pretense that I was playing, but I really wasn't playing. I wasn't, because if I would have blown into my instrument with that, you know, that reed that was about 6 months past due, it would have sounded like some dying geese. But here I am fingering. All the same, my fake fingering was more convincing than Hunter in this movie playing his trumpet, although the sounds emitted from his trumpet were way better than my saxophone.
Oh,
so,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, it kind of works out.
Unbelievable. And what is also unbelievable, if that didn't set the tone for this thing, it is, in addition to a green screen fest, this is total exposition fest. Anyone who's introduced as a character just fills in like stucco in a wall. The most incredible exposition of who has been involved, who is doing what to whom, who's involved with the FBI, who, there's references to Edward Snowden, of all people, and there's people who are just there in order to further the plot, who only appear to discuss how everything ties together.
Yeah.
It makes absolutely no sense.
Now, ultimately, I mean, even though Hunter is part of this sex crimes division of the LAPD, there's a coupler out there. And he's investigating it, even though
this is not a sex crime.
It has
crime.
Nothing to do with a sex crime. It's just somebody who's killing cops.
Yeah.
Lots of cops. And every time there's a victim, it says victim number 47, you know?
Yeah, and there's even a letter designation. Like, does Los Angeles have so many murders that they have to add the letter R and L to the victim number? Whatever, victim 14Z. Done. Next one. And the MO of the killer is a little bit weird, too, because they use a lollipop.
Well, that's one of the weapons, but, I mean, the killer also uses a high heel at one point.
Yes.
The sharpened lollipop comes near the end. That was the incredible finale, where Hunter is basically dodging a pointed lollipop stick, you know, doing his pathetic Aikido or whatever that he was doing. But yeah, look, I think spoiler, can we spoil if you're not spoiled? The reality of the matter is, I don't know who's going to see this movie. I don't know who's going to find this movie.
Well, I hope they do. Yeah.
I hope they do, I really do. But they reveal who the killer is. Like, we as the audience know who the killer is.
Yeah.
It's Kelly, it's this runaway.
Yeah.
And
oh, this is a stretch. This is, has a little bit of film noir elements to it because she is a femme fatale. They live
by
together.
Night, she's by a femme fatale.
Yeah, and during the day, she's just some runaway who's so doting on Hunter and really appreciative of this father figure who's taken her in when she's got this difficult family life.
But then by night, he's not of her because at one point, I mean, he's literally dragging her out of his apartment by her legs, yeah. saying, "You overstay your welcome. Get out." You know.
Oh, and we got to discuss the apartment too, because Hunter's digs. He said the police station, which has a sign that says "lobby" above. The door, which is clearly a high school, very nakedly a high school, this alleged police station. His home is clearly some condo with a front door, in quotes, that opens to a hallway. But they try and obscure it, but it really is not a house that you would think from the exterior. The doors shake, it's clearly some cheap set, opens into a hallway. His family life is interesting, too. He just lives on his own, apart from his guest there, the runaway, and he guzzles Maker's Mark out of the bottle that he has on his dining room table.
Okay, but did you notice, I mean, the bottle of Maker's Mark, I mean, for a couple of connoisseurs of the bevy like you and I mean, it's unmistakable.
Yeah.
But did you notice that the word Maker's was actually obscured?
Yes, yeah, but not Mark.
Tape covering the word Maker's. You know, like
which is funny that you mentioned Gold's Gym, because I didn't notice, I thought this is a weird belt, and I thought, oh, it's just a girdle, but then when he's lying on the couch, you can clearly see Jim and Gold's Jim. So they're trying to obscure, but doing a very, very bad job. Mm-hmm. So, okay, kudos to Maker's Mark and Gold's Jim for getting free advertising to the 10,000 people who are going to watch this thing. If that, I think that's charitable by half. My God. So the body count rises.
There's ultimately over 50 victims of this cop killer.
Yeah, lots of cops are ending up in compromising positions, mm-hmm. Ending up dead in bathrooms, in the front seat of vehicles. There's a whole backstory with Captain Goodwill being involved somehow in double dealings and crookedness, even though she's the captain of this unit.
What about Mama Woods' cabin?
Mama Woods' cabin. Mama Woods is the Tennessee mother of Kelly.
Of Kelly, yeah. And he goes to her cabin to
find Kelly, because he finally suspects her, possibly, of being involved in this. He wants to know where she is.
Mm-hmm.
He drives out to Tennessee. And this is weird, too, because in his vehicle, this is filmed digitally, there's a few starts and stops, like staggers, where the filming was stopped, and they just continued. They didn't edit it out. One of the many problems. They go to Tennessee, which, again, is just part of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
She's sitting there with,
again, green screen.
The interior of her house is green screen.
Yep.
Why couldn't they just find another house?
They had a green screen.
yeah. They really made so much use of this thing. And at her, she's a nutcase. At her table, she's got place settings for three mannequins.
Yeah. And she's sitting there talking to mannequins.
Mm-hmm.
Again, why? What's the significance? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's completely bizarre. But ultimately, the most bizarre thing of this movie, I mean, like I said, the plot is convoluted. There's so many different subplots that really have nothing to do with the overarching plot of trying to find this cop killer. There's so many non sequiturs. Near the end, Hunter reveals that in his home, in a closet, he's got a 24/7 reel-to-reel tape recorder, which is sending every conversation directly to his attorney. And I'm thinking to myself, so this attorney's on retainer for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sitting there, listening to every banal conversation around Hunter's apartment.
Yeah.
Every time he brings back his girlfriend to do some sweet loving with her, mm-hmm. he's got to listen. I mean, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck? The ending goes to this weird sort of mystical, is it real, is it a dream?
Yeah.
Very almost Neil Breenian, very Fatal Findings, very Zen.
Hitchcockian, Neil Breenian, yes.
Yeah. But the biggest enigma of this film, honestly, is it's Ron Becks. It's Hunter himself.
He moves at a glacial pace, and this includes his action moves, where he's supposed to be a quick draw. This includes his pathetic faux ersatz Aikido moves. He's a avuncular, slow-talking figure who dispenses wisdom. He's one interesting, soul-patched, cool cat, Bo Diddley. Mm-hmm. And he pretty much sleepwalks through this entire thing at a very, very He works at his own pace. Let's put it that way. He is a slow-moving fellow, and he can't take your eyes off him. I hope he makes another film. I don't know in what capacity.
Mm-hmm.
He's unmistakable and unforgettable.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a question. In the pantheon of, like, you know, the so bad there, it's inconceivable movies that we love to watch. Where would you put Hunter?
Well, I'd put it very high. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how this thing ran 80 minutes, and it requires probably a third and fourth viewing just to figure out what the hell is going on,
mm-hmm.
because it is more convoluted than Detective Gitz and your Jack Nicholson's and your anything, your any detective caper, any film noir. I don't know what's going on.
It's basically more convoluted than String Theory.
It really is. It's mind-blowing. It's mystifying.
Yeah. The only experience I can liken this to of a film that we podcasted way back when was Cracker Jack 3.
Yes,
where
yes.
I'm watching that movie, and I'm watching these, you know, septuagenarian expendables, you know.
Oh, Svensson, yeah, yeah, indeed,
and
yeah.
And I'm watching going, like, is this for real? Like, yeah. Am I supposed to take this seriously? Or is this meant to be some sort of intentional or unintentional comedy? It's impossible to take seriously, but at the same time, there's no real sort of nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah.
It's weird netherworld of, like, well, this, I think, the filmmaker...
It's straight. I think so.
Mm-hmm. It's played straight. It's not played for laughs. But how anybody in their right mind could work on this set and not... surmise, and this is the most ludicrous thing yeah. that they're ever putting on, well, I was going to say celluloid, but digital,
yeah,
whatever,
digital.
You know, one
yeah.
zeros, I have no fucking clue.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling that this thing exists, that this film was actually made. Thank God it was made. Uh-huh. I love it. I mean, you know, this is sort of like my raison d'etre sometimes, these sort of movies, but, wow, I mean, there's another, and then there's one thing in this movie that I found is so wrong-headed, though, I must say. We did talk about Hunter's girlfriend, who at one point just out of nowhere says, "Hunter, I don't love you anymore. I was just using you for the money. Blah, blah, blah. We're done." And
yeah.
That's the end of that, you know? That was just a scene that was totally fueled.
Yeah.
But when they showed the orphans that were under her charge, they cut some stock footage. And it must have been stock footage of, like, some refugees in some war-torn African country.
Yes.
They were supposed to represent orphans
yeah.
in Los Angeles. It was so...
Reminds me of the Orpins from Miami Connection.
No, but this is this,
yeah,
this,
no,
this
no,
was
I know,
offensive.
I know.
This was goddamn offensive. I mean, as much as everything else was just ludicrously hilarious, that piece of stock footage, that was wrong, man.
And at the outset of this podcast, we played a little snippet of the Hunter theme, and he's a man of action, a man of steel.
More like a man of belly, but
he really is. He's a man who loves the buffet table.
He's a man of
healthy portions.
Yeah.
But I was thinking too, like the music in this thing is so bewildering that there's a sergeant at the LAPD.
Well, I was going to say, sir, I'm going to interrupt. I know where you're going. When you were talking about the active international flavor of this, I thought that you were going to bring this gentleman up at that point. But now you're going to bring it up.
Okay,
yes.
I want to say he's Sergeant Bahan or Sergeant Baran. And he's a Persian fellow with a mustache and a bald pate. And he's completely indecipherable. And every line he utters, it's just nothing. And he must have been a producer because there's some Persian names, this thing, that probably bankrolled this. Mm-hmm. When he is on screen, the background music is this Farsi Persian music that drowns out some of his dialogue, and you don't know why would you drown out his dialogue? Because you can't understand him. He needs to be pristinely heard.
Oh my God, I'm crying right now because I'm thinking the last cab ride I took. You know, where basically that's what the driver was
yeah,
playing.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Farsi Persian music. It's kind of cool. Like, I don't
yeah,
mind
yeah.
Music.
It was fun. And every character, their ethnic provenance was dictated by the soundtrack. So you had the one Latina character, and she has salsa music. This guy is Persian. He has Farsi music. Hunter has God knows what, a little bit of funk and a little bit of that inexplicably weird intro music. Now we have to get... Well, we've covered so much of what we learned here.
Well, okay.
We're going to get into what we've learned.
Well, I will
this.
Say, okay, so what we learned, we'll talk about momentarily, what we didn't learn is really what this movie is really about. Because it's so fucking convoluted. But yeah. What did we learn? Okay.
Great, great stuff. The lines are fantastic. Hunter, again, he dispenses with homilies and wisdom. Like, parents influence us, but they don't define us. So he gives these little speeches, but he's not the only one. Captain Goodwill is a dispenser of advice, too. When she is talking to runaway Kelly, she's new to the streets of the big city, and the city of angels. She's from small town Tennessee.
It's been a cowboy, dude.
Yeah.
LA and New York.
And as she is being taught how to live on the streets by Captain Goodwill, they'll try and get by, teach her some street savvy. She tells her at one point, if you're attacked, yell out, I have a disease. That is your street smarts there, right from the captain's mouth. Mm. That's what I learned. My God, so many incredible lines. What did you learn?
I'm going to deviate a bit from what I learned to what I want to see, okay?
A sequel?
I would love to see, a sequel would be wonderful. Because you were mentioning, you're saying, well, you know, I'd like to see more about Ron Bex. What I want to see, like, enough of, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin and Steven Seagal. Enough of, you know, Steven Seagal with, you know, Vinnie Jones. I want to see Steven Seagal and Ron Bex teaming up.
That would be
up.
Fantastic.
And I want to see them as adversaries. I want to see them going at it with their, with their, you know, Aikido moves. Because, yeah. I mean, you know, say what we will about Seagal. I mean, the man was once incredible. He's now just about as glacial as this amateur here. Ron Bex. That would be akin to watching, like, a glacier melt or something, mm-hmm. You know? I don't know, man. That would just be the most hilarious thing to see Ron Bex and Steven Seagal go mono a mono.
He definitely needs...
In front of a green screen.
Yes. He definitely needs some foil because he doesn't have maybe the physical gifts of his JCVD, so he has to use some of his, I guess, cunning and some of his resourcefulness to get to the bottom of things. He's a really interesting fellow. Love to see more of him. Star rating.
Wow, yeah. Again.
Okay, as a real movie, again, it's a half star.
It's a half a star. maybe three quarters of a star. But so bad, it's just wonderful movie, I'm going to have to give this one. I know you gave it 4 stars on our review, and I'm assuming you're going to stick to that on the review on our website.
Yeah, with the caveat that this is very definitely bad movie territory. Mm-hmm. It's a good companion piece to Dangerous Men, although that one has a more languid, leisurely pace, mm-hmm. but it has the same, well, similar structural flaws to this thing. My God, so many structural flaws. There's too many to count. We're only just scratching the surface here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to give it 3.5, maybe 3.75.
That seems fair.
Yeah, as far as, you know, on that sort of scale. So, yeah, I'm not saying it's a 4-star bad movie.
No.
So, I give it 3.75. You give it 4 stars. All the same, it's well worth seeing. If you could track this thing down, Ron Bex, Hunter.
Yeah.
By Gregory Hatanaka, it's well worth 80 odd minutes of your life.
For sure. And check
and
out
you can our, thank us later.
Yes, and check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.